Welcome to today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, December 8th, 2024. It is hard to ignore the news that reminds us that many in the world don't have enough to eat. In a photo that accompanies an article in the combined July 13th, July 27th issue of Science News, we see children holding out plates in Rafah, in the southern part of the Gaza Strip, hoping to get food on that plate. Children wait for food in February amid the Israeli-Hamas war. Up to 9% of children under the age of 5 in southern Gaza are malnourished. Malnutrition's effects on the body don't end when food arrives, research shows. And that percentage has undoubtedly gone up since February. The article in this issue of Science News is entitled Surviving Childhood Malnutrition. Inflammation and gut problems can persist after recovery. New treatments may repair damage, by Tina Hessman-Sai. Denise Potvin, a nurse working in Rafah, a city in the south of the Gaza Strip, has been seeing something new recently, malnutrition among young children. Before the current Israel-Hamas war, there weren't cases of malnutrition, Potvin says. Now we are seeing cases. As of June 6th, 32 people there, including at least 28 children, have died of malnutrition. In southern Gaza, up to 9% of children under age 5 are malnourished, according to the World Health Organization. In northern Gaza, the fraction is greater. Up to a quarter of children are malnourished, 2 to 3 standard deviations below the average weight for height score for their age. And up to 4% are severely malnourished, more than 3 standard deviations below average. The International Integrated Food Security Phase Classification Partnership warned in a report in March that famine is imminent in northern Gaza and the rest of Gaza is also at risk. Last May, a Dutch think tank warned that if fighting continued, which it did, that the children of Gaza would not be alone. In Sudan, up to 2.5 million people could die of malnutrition by the end of this year if ongoing fighting there continues. Kids in Afghanistan, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Haiti, Nigeria, Pakistan, Yemen, and other countries are also experiencing malnutrition as a result of conflict, poverty, natural disasters, and other factors that leave them suddenly without food. Those abrupt disruptions can lead to acute malnutrition and wasting, and, if the situation becomes prolonged, chronic malnutrition, stunting, and even death. Worldwide last year, 2023, an estimated 36.4 million children under the age of 5 were acutely malnourished, with 9.8 million of them suffering severe malnutrition, according to the 2024 Global Report on Food Crises. In 2022, about 148 million children had stunting, being too short for their age, and 45 million had wasting, too thin for their height, with more than 13 million with severe wasting. Nearly half of deaths of young children, especially of children in low and middle income countries, are linked to undernutrition. Even for children who get treatment, malnutrition can lead to a lifetime of consequences. These include an elevated chance of dying in the year or so after recovery, stunted growth, and a reduced ability to achieve their full intellectual capacity, even as adults. Recent research offers insight into the physiological factors that lead to long-term problems and provides hope that new treatments might heal the lingering damage that can torment survivors of malnutrition. A weakened immune system. A body suffering from malnutrition must expend energy on essentials, like keeping the heart and lungs functioning. To do so, the body cuts back in other important areas, says Indy Trehan, a pediatrician at the University of Washington in Seattle. Some of the things that it's not going to spend its energy on very much is growing taller, which is part of the job of kids' bodies, he says. It's not going to spend a lot of energy on developing neurons and brain connections, healing cuts and scrapes, or keeping up body temperature. One of the most serious cutbacks is in the immune system, he says. The immune system will start to fall apart, leaving malnourished people susceptible to dying from infections that well-nourished people can more easily get over. For instance, in a review of studies of malnutrition, researchers found that young kids who were moderately underweight for their age are twice as likely to die of pneumonia as children at healthy weights. In Rafah, Potvin, who works with the International Medical Humanitarian Organization, Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French abbreviation MSF, is watching the reinforcing dynamic between malnutrition and the immune system play out. You see everybody living in tents, overcrowded situations, situations with lack of access to proper water and hygiene and sanitation, she says. Those conditions can increase the risk of malnourished children catching infectious diseases that can, in turn, make malnutrition worse. In the MSF clinics in Rafah, Potvin says, we are seeing a lot of respiratory tract infections, diarrheal illnesses, and different skin conditions. Death even after treatment. Globally, only a fraction of children with severe acute malnutrition get life-saving treatment, which typically includes an energy-dense, nutrient-rich, ready-to-use therapeutic food. About 1 in 5 children hospitalized for severe malnutrition will die before being discharged, says Gerard Brian Gonzalez, a public health nutritionist at Ghent University in Belgium. Fixing malnutrition isn't as simple as giving a child food. Even after leaving a hospital and returning home, children are prone to dying. A paper published in 2018 in PLOS-1 that reviewed multiple studies found that up to 10% of severely malnourished young children die in the 6 months to 2 years after leaving the hospital. The true figure may be even higher, because up to 45% of kids dropped out of the reviewed studies, so their fates couldn't be determined, researchers reported. In a study of severely malnourished children under age 5 in Kenya, Gonzalez and colleagues found that about 10% of kids, 177 out of 1,704, landed back in the hospital within a year of being discharged. It's unclear why so many children die after being treated for malnutrition, says James Njungi, a biochemist at the KEMRI Wellcome Trust Research Program in Kilifi, Kenya. What is known is that by the time children are malnourished, a complex cascade has started in the body that may not be completely reversible. Njungi and colleagues are studying the blood and waste of children who died from severe malnutrition after leaving the hospital. From this research spanning multiple countries, the team hopes to learn whether certain proteins, hormones, nutrients, gut microbes, or other factors can explain the children's deaths. Both inflammation and damaged metabolism were associated with death in severely malnourished children in Kenya and Malawi, who also had infections or other health problems. Njungi and colleagues reported in the journal Science Advances in 2022 their results. But there's another conflicting factor. Some families may take their children home before they're fully recovered, against medical advice, he says, perhaps because the parents need to care for other children or return to work. Persistent inflammation. Even when kids do recover and have caught up with their peers for weight, bouts of malnutrition can cause internal damage that may linger for years. Recent work suggests that some malnourished children have very, very aggressive inflammation against either active infections or bits of bacteria that may leak out of their guts, Njungi says. The inflammatory process is supposed to be a good thing to protect you from these pathogens, but when it is too strong, he says, it can damage tissues and organs. In addition, inflammation can impair how the body absorbs and uses nutrients. All those factors can lead to organ damage, and that's what eventually leads to mortality. Compared with well-nourished preschoolers in their communities, 264 severely malnourished children in Zimbabwe and Zambia still had signs of high inflammation in their blood about a year after being released from the hospital. Jonathan Sturgeon, a pediatrician at Queen Mary University of London, and colleagues reported February 28th in the journal Science Translational Medicine. The fact that inflammation continued for at least a year after discharge was quite a surprise, Sturgeon says. And the inflammation isn't just apparent in the children's blood. It's also in their guts, Sturgeon reports. People's intestinal walls have tiny finger-like structures called villi. These little fingers increase the amount of surface area that can absorb nutrients from food. But in children with severe malnutrition, the villi become quite blunted, quite flat, quite thin, quite friable, Sturgeon says. Those changes mirror some of the inflammatory bowel changes you see in children from the West with inflammatory bowel disease. That type of change to the villi could mean even after malnutritionment ends, children may have lingering trouble absorbing the nutrients needed to grow and develop properly, perhaps setting these kids up for a lifetime of health problems. Sturgeon and colleagues have been testing drugs that may repair the gut lining in malnourished children. A molecule called teduglutide reduced markers of inflammation in young children being treated for severe malnutrition in Zambia and Zimbabwe, the team found. The compound, which is used to treat short bowel syndrome, also restored growth of villi, the researchers reported on April 17th in the journal Nature Communications. The promise of new treatments. Other researchers are also developing new treatments to help with the lasting consequences of malnutrition. Children with malnutrition often have underdeveloped gut microbiomes, says Jeffrey Gordon, a microbiome researcher at Washington State School of Medicine in St. Louis. In most children, the rise and fall of certain types of gut bacteria follows a predictable developmental pattern, but that pattern is disturbed in kids with malnutrition. In those kids, there are features of the microbial community that appear younger or more immature than you would expect based on the chronological age, Gordon says. Those disturbances can affect development of the gut and immune system, perhaps causing kids to have lasting digestive issues and immune system problems, he adds. There is a photograph of a Doctors Without Borders worker who is measuring the mid-upper arm circumference of a child in a refugee camp in Chad. That measurement, along with the child's height and weight, are used to gauge the severity of malnutrition. Gordon and colleagues developed a therapeutic food that fosters gut microbe growth. It's a mix of chickpea, soybean, and peanut flours, mashed green banana, plus sugar and soybean oil. The researchers tested the microbe-fostering food against a standard therapeutic food composed of rice, lentil, and milk powder with sugar and soybean oil. The experimental food helped toddlers gain weight faster, even though it has fewer calories, Gordon's team reported in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2021. The toddlers gained weight due to the presence of two strains of Prevotella coppery bacteria, which broke down molecules in the microbe-nourishing food, the researchers reported on March 19th in the journal Nature Microbiology. Knowing how microbes and specific molecules within food work together may help researchers design even better therapeutic foods to treat or even prevent malnutrition, Gordon says. A global effort. Because so many children die from malnutrition, few studies have been able to determine the consequences of childhood starvation on adults. What researchers do know is that severe malnutrition or exposure to famine in childhood is associated with an increased risk of high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, and metabolic problems such as diabetes. This was reported by Gonzalez and colleagues in the BMJ Global Health Journal in 2021. Part of the problem may be the high fat content of the diets that are traditionally used to treat malnutrition, Gonzalez says. It might stress the system too much so that the body has this long-term persistent dysregulation. Right now, treatment strategies focus on keeping children from dying in the next year. We are trying ways now to really study whether we are giving children what they really need, Gonzalez says. Are we treating them in a way that they don't only survive, but they are also thriving? And it's a time-sensitive question, Trehan says. If young children don't get proper nutrition while their brains are developing, you're not going to catch up no matter how good your schools and your rehab and things like that are after the fact. People who survive severe malnutrition in childhood may be a bit shorter than if they'd gotten enough food to grow to their genetic potential. That's probably not a big deal, but stunting can be an indicator of missed intellectual development. We want smart kids who can then do good in school and then get good jobs and then help their societies develop, he says. With malnutrition, you're really hitting a population for the long term. In a study in Congo, people who had been severely malnourished as children were less likely as adults to report doing well in school, had less education, and lower self-esteem than peers in their communities who were never malnourished, researchers reported in 2020 in PLOS One. It's not just the people who suffered food shortages that pay the price, Gonzalez says. When chronic health problems arise in formerly malnourished people, health systems around the world can become stressed, especially as people migrate from one place to another. A health issue in one part of the world has ripple effects. Malnutrition, he says, is a global problem that requires global solutions. And there is a photograph that compares different conditions of the gut. It's called Repairing the Gut. Finger-like extensions called villi on the walls of the intestines help the body absorb nutrients. But malnutrition blunts the growth of villi. And the picture shows you that you don't have the finger-like extensions that you do in healthy guts. There is an atrophy during the severe malnutrition. In some children with severe malnutrition, the villi are nearly absent even after standard therapy, which is what is shown in the third photograph. The gut is very pale now. But adding the compound teduglutide to treatment may help restore the growth of these structures. And in the fourth picture, you see that, what the intestine looks like after that treatment. Surviving childhood malnutrition. Inflammation and gut problems can persist after recovery. New treatments may repair damage. Appeared in the July 13th, July 27th, 2024 double issue of Science News. If you listen to any orchestra broadcasts, there's a good chance that you will hear one recorded in David Geffen Hall. The New York Philharmonic's home underwent an extensive renovation that was finished 2 years ago. But that was only the beginning of the quest for the perfect sound. This article, posted in the New York Times on October 8, 2024, was written by Javier C. Hernandez. When the New York Philharmonic English horn player and oboist, Ryan Roberts, performs at the renovated David Geffen Hall these days, he feels naked and exposed, as if he were appearing on a high-definition television screen. "The sound is honest," he said. "You hear everything, for better or for worse." The star violinist, Hilary Hahn, a frequent soloist, has a sense of comfort. "You can trust your sound will project," she said. And John Adams, the composer and conductor, said that gone were the days of a concert hall that felt like Yankee Stadium. "It's such a breath of fresh air," he said. "You can go for much greater delicacy and subtlety." Geffen Hall, the home of the New York Philharmonic, reopened 2 years ago after a $550 million renovation. By gutting and rebuilding the interior, the project was meant to break, once and for all, the acoustical curse that had plagued the hall for decades. Unveiling the new space, the Philharmonic's leaders declared a new era, clinking champagne glasses and hailing our 2,200-seat crown jewel. So, after 2 years and more than 270 concerts, how does the hall sound? While the acoustics are still evolving, the reviews of Geffen Hall have largely been positive. The hall is more resonant and enveloping, according to more than a dozen Philharmonic players, guest artists, conductors, and audience members. But there are still shortcomings. The hall, some say, can be cool and clinical, and at the highest volumes, blaring. "It's definitely better than it was," said Rebecca Young, the Philharmonic's associate principal viola, who joined in 1986, "but I don't think it's perfect." Since Geffen Hall reopened, technicians have made several adjustments, tinkering with the placement of acoustical panels. The orchestra's players are still learning to play in the space. The brass players have tempered their sound, and the strings are working on blend. Even more changes could come in 2026, when the conductor Gustavo Dudamel takes over as the Philharmonic's music and artistic director. He could adjust the seating arrangement of the orchestra and fine-tune the balance of each section, or he may ask for changes in the angling of acoustical panels spread throughout the space. A photo of the orchestra on stage, taken from the back of the stage, says, "The New York Philharmonic rehearsing in the newly renovated hall 2 years ago. It's as if you were driving an old jalopy and somebody gave you a really high-performance sports car," said Deborah Borda, a veteran Philharmonic leader who recently returned on an interim basis. "You have to learn how to drive very differently. Our musicians have had to learn to play an entirely new instrument." Jaap van Zweden, the Philharmonic's music director from 2018 until this past summer, said the ensemble had already achieved a good balance in its new auditorium. But, he added, "for a lot of musicians, the old hall is still in their DNA. Give them some time and you will get what you are looking for." For decades, the Philharmonic has faced questions about the acoustics of its home. When the orchestra opened in Philharmonic Hall at Lincoln Center in 1962, it was a glittering affair. The audience included Jackie Kennedy, Nelson Rockefeller, and Adlai Stevenson. But the hall's faults were immediately apparent, a critical problem for an art form that relies on unamplified instruments. The Philharmonic's players had trouble hearing one another on stage, and audience members strained to hear the voices of the orchestra. The hall, a drab shoebox auditorium, was cavernous and impersonal, with nearly a third of the audience more than 100 feet from the stage. "Tear the place down and start over again," was the blunt advice of the conductor George Zell, who led concerts there with the Cleveland Orchestra. After many ill-fated attempts to fix the problems over the years, including a gut renovation in 1976, plans for a radical reimagining of the hall finally took shape before the pandemic. The renovation was kick-started by a $100 million gift from Geffen, a Brooklyn-born entertainment mogul. The leaders of Lincoln Center and the Philharmonic worked together to accelerate construction during the pandemic, finishing a year and a half ahead of schedule. To make the hall more intimate, 500 seats were eliminated, along with the proscenium. The stage was pulled 25 feet forward, with seats wrapping around it. Beechwood panels were installed along the walls, each with embellishments to help reduce the edge of higher frequencies. Seats upholstered in a floating flower petal motif filled the auditorium. After the latest renovation, though, new questions about the hall's acoustics surfaced. Critics said that while the sound was consistent and lucid, it could also be stiff and disjointed. "The music remains stuck in front of you instead of rushing around you," the New Yorker critic Alex Ross wrote after the opening concerts in 2022. "I had the sense that I was listening to a world-class stereo system in a dry room." Critics' concerns have persisted. Zachary Wolf, writing in the New York Times in January 2024, said that a performance of a Wagner prelude emphasized the unpleasant way that, in densely massed music, the stark lucidity of Geffen Hall's acoustics can tip into brittle blare rather than warm blend. While the hall has drawn inevitable, unfavorable comparisons with Carnegie Hall, its storied neighbor known for luxurious acoustics, some say the contrast is unfair. "What we did is absolutely the most we could get out of the existing hall," Van Sveden said. "You cannot expect a completely new hall. It's an impossible dream." The conductor, Stéphane Deneuve, said he noticed some difficulties when he took the podium just a few weeks after Geffen Hall reopened. "It was hard," he said, "to conjure the supple colors he needed for a program of Ravel and Roussel." All of the great qualities of the New York Philharmonic, this very powerful orchestra, were being challenged by the liveliness of the acoustics, he said. But when Deneuve returned to New York last year to lead Beethoven, Saint-Saëns, and a premiere by Carlos Simon, he noticed a difference. "The orchestra really found a way to be warm and immersive and powerful without being too harsh or too loud," he said. "It was a spectacular change." Since the hall reopened, much of the focus has been on its sparkling visual design. The public spaces, including the lobby, have been refurbished, and the auditorium, with fewer seats, looks and feels more intimate. The pianist Emmanuel Ax said, "Everything felt distant in the old hall." Some of the positive reaction to the renovation, he added, might be attributable not just to the sound, but also to the psychological relief of feeling closer to the music. And this update on the renovated David Geffen Hall, the home of the New York Philharmonic, which underwent an extensive renovation that was finished 2 years ago, appeared in the New York Times on October 8, 2024. If you're drinking wine with your holiday meals, there's a good chance that one of them will be a Bordeaux. In this New York Times trilobite posted on December 5th, 2023, yes, a year ago, Bordeaux wine snobs have a point, it says, according to this computer model. In the Bordeaux region of southwest France, scores of vineyard estates transform finicky grapes into bold blends of red wine. Some bottles sell for thousands of dollars each. Terroir, prestigious chateaus, boast about the soil, microclimate, and traditional methods that make their own wine superior, an inscrutable mix known as terroir. It's one of those terms that the wine industry likes to keep a bit mysterious, part of the magic of wine, said Alex Bouget, a computational neuroscientist at the University of Geneva. Dr. Puget is trying to apply chemical precision to this je ne sais quoi. In a study published a few weeks ago in the journal Communications Chemistry, he and his colleagues described a computer model that could pinpoint which Bordeaux estate produced a wine based only on its chemical makeup. The model also predicted the year in which the wine was made, known as its vintage, with about 50% accuracy. Although wine connoisseurs often claim to be able to distinguish among wines from top estates, they rarely do blind taste tests, he said. People have made those claims for decades, but we've never actually had an objective measurement that showed that this was true, he said. Dr. Puget grew up in Paris in a family that drank only Bordeaux. "You pretend Burgundy does not exist," he said. As a young neuroscientist in the late 1980s, he studied the brain with machine learning, a type of artificial intelligence that identifies patterns in large data sets. He believed that these methods could be useful for the wine industry, but didn't get around to testing the idea for 30 years. He teamed up with Stéphanie Marchand from the Institute of Vine and Wine Science in Bordeaux, who had created a database of 80 wines of various vintages from 7 chateaus. The database held the chemical signatures of each wine gleaned from gas chromatography, an old and inexpensive method for breaking substances down into their molecular components. The researchers trained an algorithm to seek common patterns in the chemical fingerprints of the wines. They were shocked by the results. The model grouped the wines into distinct clusters that matched with their geographical locations in the Bordeaux region. This showed that the particularities of each estate had drastically influenced the chemistry of the wines produced there, just as winemakers have claimed for centuries. The estates gave the researchers permission to study their wines on the condition that they not be named. Dr. Bouget said that all of the wines were part of the famous 1855 Bordeaux classification, a ranking instituted by Napoleon III to promote the best wines of Bordeaux. Dr. Bouget was surprised that the winemakers did not want to disclose their names, as the study's findings reinforced the notion that their wines were special. "I have scientific evidence that it makes sense to charge people money for this because they are producing something unique," he said, laughing. Independent researchers said that the study was part of a wave of recent research using machine learning to decipher terroir. "This is where the field is headed and needs to head to make sense of an abundance of data," said David Jeffrey, an expert in wine chemistry at the University of Adelaide in Australia. For example, he has used machine learning to classify Shiraz wines from the Barossa Valley in Australia. The approach, Dr. Jeffrey said, is not only about what makes a great wine chemically. The models could also help producers adjust their growing and winemaking practices to preserve their product's character in years of unexpected weather. "This is especially important in the face of a changing climate," he said. Another application of these models, experts say, is rooting out fraud, which is fairly common among expensive wines. Producers have adjusted their bottles, labels, and corks to make them harder to copy. If there is a doubt about the origin of a wine, analyzing a wine sourced from the estate as a benchmark would probably allow to know whether the wine is fake or not, said Cornelius van Leeuwen, the head of the viticulture and oenology department at Bordeaux Sciences Agro. The approach would probably work for any wine region, so long as the model has been trained on a large array of wines from different producers and vintages, said Dr. van Leeuwen, who was not involved in the new study. An open question, though, is whether the model would retain its accuracy after a few years, he said. Even inside a bottle, wine changes over time, which means it could diverge from the patterns captured in the database. Dr. Bouget, who has a large wine collection, hopes to repeat the study using some of his favorite kinds from the Châteauneuf-du-Pape region in southeastern France. "But among the best wines," he said, "age is probably more important than provenance. I only drink old wine," he said. "I think drinking things when they're younger than 15 years is a bit criminal." And this article was written by Virginia Hughes, who is an editor on the Health and Science Desk. This New York Times Trilobite was posted on December 5th, 2023. The following articles were previously broadcast on September 1st, 2024. We turn to a short article in News, the Department of Health and Medicine, How to Keep Cats Safe from Bird Flu. Pet owners can take steps to avoid the H5N1 virus. This June 29th, 2024 issue of Science News article is written by Tina Hessman-Say. A growing number of cats are getting and dying of bird flu, sparking worries about the risk that the ongoing outbreak poses for feline furballs and their humans. The current U.S. outbreak of highly pathogenic H5N1 virus has been sickening and killing wild birds and poultry since 2021. H5N1 has also jumped into mammals, including farm animals such as goats, dairy cattle, and alpacas. When this happens, if the virus gets a random mutation that helps it replicate better in mammalian cells, the bird flu could adapt to spread easily in people. There's no sign yet that the virus has acquired the changes needed for person-to-person transmission, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention reported on May 24th of this year. Out of the handful of people who have been infected in the United States, so far, most were in close contact with poultry or cattle, but bird flu showed up in domestic cats. That might give the virus an easier route to infecting people. After all, most people are more likely to encounter and cuddle kitties than chickens or cows. How cats get bird flu. Outdoor cats may contact the virus after catching an infected bird. Whether or not the cats eat the bird, says Megan Davis, a veterinarian and environmental epidemiologist at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. The food that people feed their cats could also put the animals at risk to contracting the virus. Davis says, raw meat diets and specifically raw poultry diets have been associated with some outbreaks. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has found viral particles in muscle and other tissue from a culled dairy cow, the agency said on May 24th. None of the meat entered the food supply, but the incident highlights that raw beef might contain the virus. Raw, unpasteurized cow milk has also become an avenue for infection. Raw milk, some of which is labeled for pet use only, could be a way that indoor cats that don't have direct contact with birds could get infected, Davis says. Water or surfaces contaminated with bird droppings also might be potential sources of infection. Some evidence suggests that cats might pass the virus to each other, Davis adds. Bird flu can be deadly for cats. In 2022 and 2023, at least 13 cats in the U.S. got bird flu, and about half died. Some were farm cats that had contact with infected chickens, but some were domestic cats that somehow got sick. So far in 2024, more than 20 cats have contracted H5N1, most of them on dairy farms, the World Organization for Animal Health reports. At least 5 have died. The numbers of infections and deaths are likely higher. For instance, about half of 24 cats that were fed raw milk from infected cattle on one Texas farm earlier this year died, researchers reported in the July issue of Emerging Infectious Diseases. Those cases don't appear to be counted by the World Organization for Animal Health. Symptoms before the Texas cats' deaths included stiff body movements, wobbliness, circling, runny noses, and blindness. Researchers examined 2 of the dead cats and found evidence that the virus had infected their whole bodies. The infection may have killed the cats after reaching the brain. Unfortunately, it's not great news if we get to that point, Davis says. The risk to people seems to be low, however. It's rare but possible for people to catch bird flu from animals, the CDC says, though the exact odds haven't yet been established. Even less clear is whether particularly susceptible people, such as those with weakened immune systems, who live with cats, might have a higher risk of getting infected. Public health agencies stress that the risk of getting bird flu is low for people who aren't exposed to infected birds and their droppings or to other infected animals. Protecting cats and yourself. There are no bird flu vaccines available for cats right now, so keeping felines inside is the best form of protection. For cats that go outside, limit their exposure to bird feces, Davis says. Keep the bird feeders out of the catio. Pet owners can further limit exposure by cleaning their shoes after walking in places where there are bird droppings, disinfecting surfaces where shoes are stored, and keeping shoes away from cats. If your cat brings home a dead bird, don't touch the bird if you can help it. Otherwise, put on a mask, Davis says, gloves and goggles, before disposing of the bird. If you don't have protective gear, a stick in a box will do. Wash your hands after handling the bird. Monitor the cat and let your vet know if it becomes ill. Symptoms tend to appear 2 to 3 days after infection. Finally, don't give cats food that might contain H5N1, especially raw meat or raw milk, Davis says. Not feeding these products to pets is as important as not consuming them yourselves. This article, How to Keep Cats Safe from Bird Flu, appears in the June 29, 2024 issue of Science News. We have in brief, first, Silk, A World History by Arathi Prasad, published by William Morrow in 2024. A silk garment is not a single object, but a composite of thousands of individual silkworm cocoons. Likewise, there is no single history of silk. Biologist and writer Arathi Prasad unwinds tangled threads to weave one arc through China, India, Europe, and South America. We learn about dogged early scientists who crossed oceans and amassed massive personal collections to better understand silk's biology and production. Fascinating facts abound. Bombyx mori is just one of a bevy of wild and domesticated silk-producing moths. Sea silk can be isolated from a giant mollusk. Despite her efforts, Prasad readily asserts that many locals who shaped silk and the study remain nameless. They're missing stories, an unmendable hole. This review by Maddie Bender. And The Limits, a novel by Nell Freudenberger, published by Knopf in 2024. When teenager Pia moves back to New York City to live with her father and pregnant stepmother, she struggles with friendships, family tensions, and stifling COVID restrictions. She longs to return to the French Polynesian island of Mo'orea and to Rafi, an island native who assists with her mother's research on deep water coral. Pia's infatuation with Rafi prompts her to join his struggle against the continued exploitation and degradation of the South Pacific, inspiring her to take ever bigger risks to show her devotion. Fiction writer Nell Freudenberger masterfully captures her character's divergent perspectives and complex ties as they encounter extreme circumstances. This review written by Dana Dunham. And back to Science News for another book review in the department bookshelf. The review is entitled Climate Change in Dangerous Sports and is written by Darren Incorvalla. The book reviewed is entitled Warming Up by Madeline Orr, published by Bloomsbury Sigma. It's easy to think of sports as an escape from reality, removed from the glaring problems of our world. Researcher Madeline Orr shatters that illusion in the book Warming Up, How Climate Change is Changing Sport. In her debut book, Orr shepherds readers through an at times overwhelming deluge of all the ways climate change is disrupting sports around the world, providing a compelling case for action from athletes, sports leagues, and fans alike. Orr, a sport ecologist at the University of Toronto, draws on her academic expertise to outline how climate change is upending sports, be it wildfires almost destroying a high school football program, or rising seas subsuming coastal golf courses. While Orr bolsters her argument with data and interviews with experts, it's the personal stories that are most powerful. There's the heartbreaking story of University of Maryland college football player Jordan McNair, who died of heat stroke suffered at practice. Orr, an avid skier, shares her beef with global warming literally melting away winter sports around the world, and the local economies they sustain. In the introduction, Orr says that the order of the chapters is irrelevant, but the chapters do follow a loose organization, and grouping them into sections would have made the overall trajectory of the book easier to follow. The first 11 of the book's 17 chapters mainly focus on how warming temperatures, rising seas, increasing wildfires, and other consequences of climate change are already impacting the industry and will worsen in the future. For instance, outdoor pond hockey, a crucial part of Canada's culture and the launch pad of many of ice hockey's greats, is at risk of disappearing altogether as winters become warmer and ice becomes rarer. It's refreshing to see Orr explicitly talk about how climate change is disproportionately impacting nations that are least responsible for global greenhouse gas emissions, a point that can get lost in Western reporting on the topic. High temperatures are threatening Kenyan runners. Rising seas are eroding a famous rugby beach in Fiji. A 2022 flood devastated Pakistan's sports leagues, along with much of the country. But against the backdrop of climate change's harrowing reality, Orr keeps hope alive in the last six chapters. The sports world can adapt to climate change to reduce its own culpability and to ensure that imperiled sports survive. She spotlights the past and present activism of athletes who are fighting for sustainability. One heartening example is Innes Fitzgerald, a teenage cross-country runner who refused to fly from Britain to Australia for the 2023 World Athletics Championships out of concern for air travel's carbon emissions. Before Fitzgerald, no athlete had actually passed up championship opportunities because of a moral quandary with flying, or notes. Like climate activism in so many other sectors of society, it seems changes in sports will be spearheaded by the youth. Orr's writing is authoritative and conversational, and while she sometimes slips into academic jargon, her language is largely accessible even to readers with no scientific background. The book is jam-packed with information and has something for sports fanatics and casual fans alike. In the fight against climate change, the book, Warming Up, shows us that it's time for the sports world to play ball. And this review, Climate Change Endangers Sports, appears in the June 29, 2024 issue of Science News. We began the program with an article about old growth forests. There are many things we can learn from trees, particularly tree rings. In this New York Times trilobite posted on July 10, 2024, we learn about centuries of avalanches that are stored in tree rings. Discovering evidence of deadly deluges of snow from the past could help protect people on mountains around the world, researchers say. A rumble, a deluge of snow, and then silence. Avalanches can be deadly, but they often leave behind little enduring evidence of their passage. Now, researchers have turned to tree rings to reconstruct records of avalanches past. By analyzing the wood of hundreds of living pine trees near a ski resort in Bulgaria, a team of scientists found evidence of dozens of large avalanches that struck the area over two centuries. Understanding the frequency of potentially destructive avalanches can inform risk management efforts and land use planning, the researchers suggest. They published their results in the journal Dendrochronologia in June of this year. The Piran Mountains in southwestern Bulgaria are home to old-growth forests of pine and fir trees. Many of the trees have been standing for centuries, but some have steeply leaning trunks, while others bear conspicuous scars, such as broken branches, said Momchil Panayotov, one of the authors of the study, and a dendrochronologist at the University of Forestry in Sofia, Bulgaria. That damage, many researchers believe, was inflicted by avalanches. The mechanical impact of snow rushing downslope can severely damage a large tree and even uproot it entirely. But visible damage doesn't reveal when exactly an avalanche occurred, which is important information for reconstructing records of the dangerous events. To determine when and where avalanches have occurred in the Piran Mountains, Dr. Panayotov and Nikolay Tsvetanov, also an author of the study and a dendrochronologist at the University of Forestry, turned to tree rings. Trees that experience an avalanche develop telltale signs in their rings, Dr. Panayotov said. The survivors keep the record. In 2020 and 2021, Dr. Panayotov, Dr. Tsvetanov, and several students collected samples of wood from hundreds of pine trees in the Piran Mountains that had signs of damage. The team focused on three known avalanche corridors in the Bundaritsa Valley, home of the Bansko Ski Resort. The researchers used an instrument called an increment borer to manually extract pencil-width cores from each living tree. Back in the laboratory, Dr. Tsvetanov dried the cores, mounted them in wooden holders, and then sanded them down to reveal individual rings. It's a very long process, he said. The team then compared those tree ring records with sequences of rings obtained from nearby, undamaged trees. That cross-dating allowed the researchers to pinpoint the timing of unexpected features like suppressed growth, scars, and missing rings. Trees are amazing recorders of past disturbances, including geomorphic hazards such as snow avalanches, said Allison Carroll, a dendrochronologist at California State Polytechnic University, Humboldt, who was not involved in the research. To determine when and where avalanches have occurred in the Pirine Mountains, Dr. Panayotov and Dr. Svetanov found evidence of avalanches that took place as far back as the 1600s. But definitively concluding that an avalanche occurred that long ago is challenging, Dr. Panayotov said, as relatively few avalanche-affected trees survive for centuries. The team therefore opted to focus on more recent avalanches. The researchers inferred that over 20 large avalanches had occurred since the mid-1800s. Some of those events can be linked to historical records. For instance, the avalanche that appears in tree rings dating to 1963 is probably a documented event that occurred on February 12th of that year. But other avalanches seemingly rolled downhill into oblivion. We don't have written histories of these events, Dr. Panayotov said. We can only rely on tree rings. By analyzing the spatial positions of the affected trees, the researchers could also estimate the approximate size of each avalanche. For example, they found that the avalanche that occurred in 1969 was unusually large. It reached high up one of the corridor's banks. The team also noted that avalanches struck across all three corridors in 1963 and across two corridors in 1931, 1987, and 1996. There was some specific meteorological situations that favored big avalanches in those years, Dr. Panayotov said, like strong storms in the wintertime. But reliably predicting that avalanches are more likely in certain climatic conditions will require more data. You need time series that reach farther back in time to get good correlations between climatic conditions and avalanches, said Marcus Stoffel, an environmental scientist at the University of Geneva who was not involved in the research. Dr. Panayotov and Dr. Svetanov hope that their results will contribute to keeping winter sports enthusiasts safe. Both researchers have a vested interest. Dr. Svetanov is a snowboarder, and Dr. Panayotov is a skier who participates in mountain rescue efforts and helps oversee avalanche education and safety at the Bansko Ski Resort. "I'm a regular over there," he said. And this New York Times trilobite, "Centuries of Avalanches Are Stored in Tree Rings," was posted on July 10, 2024, and written by Catherine Cornet. And finally, from the August 10, 2024 issue of Science News, a teaser. A stellar explosion may add a temporary new star to the night sky this summer. A white dwarf pulls material off a red giant star. The accumulation of matter can trigger an eruption on the white dwarf. Keep your eyes on the night sky this summer, scanning for the constellation Corona Borealis. If you are lucky, you may glimpse what appears to be a new star winking on in the dark. The brightening point of light will not be a new star, but a nova eruption about 3,000 light years from Earth. There, a white dwarf star orbiting a red giant star tears material from its larger companion. When enough mass collects on the white dwarf's surface, the rising pressure and temperature will trigger a blast that can be seen from Earth with the naked eye, but for only a few days to a week. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, says astronomer Gerardo Juan Manuel Luna of the Universidad Nacional de Hurlingham in Argentina. We are in the right time, in the right moment, with the right instruments. The white dwarf and red giant constitute a binary system known as T Coronae Borealis, or TCRB. Astronomers think that the nova will occur by September. The CRB repeats its eruption about every 80 years. The last time this happened was in 1946. TCRB experienced a sudden brightening in recent years that astronomers call a superactive phase, followed by an apparent dip in activity, which signals the nova is probably imminent. The same pattern was observed before TCRB burst in 1946 and 1866. This time around, scientists plan to get a better view of the nearby nova than ever before. Dozens of telescopes around the world and orbiting in space will fix TCRB in their sights. We hope to be able to answer questions with this object that then might be relevant to all the other accreting and eruptive white dwarfs, says astrophysicist Jennifer Sokolowski of Columbia University. One question is whether TCRB's white dwarf gains or loses mass following each successive nova. The eruption will eject material into space, but some of the mass ripped from the red giant may sink into the white dwarf, causing the small but dense star to gain mass over time. If this is the case, then repeating novas might ultimately lead to Type 1a supernovas, which play an important role in the evolution of star systems and galaxies. That's the Holy Grail, Luna says. After the eruption, say in the next 5 years, when things are calmed down, we should be able to measure the mass again and see what happened. There will be little warning before TCRB erupts, and scientists can't be sure that it will even happen soon. Maybe we'll sit here holding our breath for the next 10 years, Sokolowski says. But if TCRB repeats past behavior, then anyone viewing the night sky from a dark place at the right moment could be the first to see this cosmic spectacle burst to life in this century. This article, posted by Jay Bennett, in the August 10th, 2024 issue of Science News. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week. Happy holidays.